Great stories about the Knicks, Clyde, Frazier, Willis Reed, DeBuscher, and others. Great talking to you, Mr. Klein. All right, it's 1 p.m. in New York City at 99.5 FM, WBAI and WBAI.org. Stay tuned for The Positive Mind with Armand DeMille.
This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind, WBAI, 99.5 FM on your dial, bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. Today in the studio with me, one of my very, very favorite authors, Dr. Judith Orloff, in here from the Pacific Ocean. Hey, Judith, welcome back.
Thank you. I'm glad to be back.
And we have a gaggle of hosts today, a gaggle, which is a group. We have in the studio today Bernard Starr and Claudia Fox, two of the most intelligent, creative, and dedicated people I know as well. So we have a room of four. There's actually Sarah's in the room. Sarah, right? She's in the room too, but not on air with us. But we have these people in the room, and the beauty of this is what happens when you get four intelligent people in a room talking about something. And that is my gift to you today. So I have our dear friend, Dr. Bernard Starr. Bernie, welcome back as usual.
Hey, great to be back here again.
Nice little conference we did over the weekend, right?
And you gave it a very rousing launch.
Yeah, and I had to leave right at launch time. And Claudia, thanks for coming back.
Thank you for having me back, Armand.
Yeah, good news. Judith, let's talk about the book. Here's your new book, right? Emotional Freedom. Emotional freedom from what?
Well, emotional freedom is being able to own the moment with any emotion and be able to have a choice about transforming negativity instead of just going down with the count with fear or worry or frustration. It's about breathing, centering, and saying, all right, how can I shift this? How can I get to the bottom of it, heal, and then shift it to something more positive?
Emotional freedom is not getting locked in to a negative emotional experience?
Yes, it's not getting encompassed by it. It's not being seduced by fear. It's saying various emotions such as fear and anger and frustration are an impetus to grow, to transform fear with courage. Let's say I pair emotions in the book, how to transform anger with compassion. So it's not in traditional psychiatry. I was taught to really, you know, learn the biological approach to medication and to treat depression and anxiety with medication. I never, ever saw that as the major answer. But I see the answer is in terms of transforming the energy of emotions into something more positive, but working with it in a really conscious way so they don't own you and you have control of them, and really, you know, learn to work with people in your life without just reacting to them, you know, with breathing, centering, and having a very mindful approach to emotions.
Well, we're going to talk about that, but are you saying that if somebody is yelling and screaming and accusing each other and crying and blackmailing and threatening and saying, I'm going to have a heart attack if you don't do what I want you to do, are you saying that that's non-functional?
I think I am.
Well, you just did away with my whole Italian family.
I did.
My poor family, they wouldn't know how to talk to each other.
I know, but we're in the midst of an economic and emotional meltdown, and we can't afford to do it the old way anymore. We have to learn how not to be seduced by fear. The masses have been manipulated by fear for millennia, and you just press a button, they feel insecure, they get into their inner child, and they could be manipulated by fear, and we can't allow that anymore. We have to learn how to shift out of fear. Finally, evolutionarily, we have to shift out of it in order to be freer ourselves and not keep repeating these patterns, and we have to be the one to change the interactions we have with people so we're not just dumping anger on someone because they irritate us.
Well, there's another part to it, Judith. You know, it's the seduction of the rage, too.
Yeah.
It is very seductive to be rageful.
It is.
You know, I mean, it's like fun. It's like it's like hard sex. You know what I mean? It's like oh, we're gonna make a lot of noise and we're gonna scream and yell and shout and get a lot of, you know, catharsis that way.
For about a minute. But it doesn't have anything to do with changing interactions or changing the paradigm of how we interact.
That's right.
We've got to do it in a new way. That old way is how they did it in the 50s. You know, they yelled, they let it out, or they emoted, you know, even in the 60s. But I'm talking about something totally different. I'm talking about, you know, this is not working anymore, either interpersonally or globally. It is not working. We have to learn to work with these energies inside of us so they don't destroy us. You know.
So you teach people how to manipulate these energies, how to work with these energies, how to change
right.
them, how
right.
to deal with them as they come up, no matter where you are.
No matter where you are, no matter what you're doing, to look at emotions as transformers and as a way to get to your higher, not your lowest self.
You know, Judith, I'm wondering now with all the job loss, if people are in more fear, and so in the workplace, say they have a boss who's a bully, they're going to be a little more afraid to stand up for themselves. I'll give you an example of something that happened to me. I had a boss who was kind of a rageful person, and I remember giving him a lead, and he sat and he met with all of us, and afterwards he came up to me in my office and said to me, you know, they should send me flowers. That was a real waste of my time. As it turned out, it was a great lead, and later on he realized that. But in the moment, I just was freaked out. I just didn't know what to do with all the emotions. I went to the ladies' room, and I remember just crying and thinking, at least get this energy out, the negative energy out, so I could go back to work. Now, how would you handle something like that?
Well, if you're stuck with a bully boss or a narcissist...
Wait a minute.
If you're stuck with a bully boss or a narcissist boss and there is no option to change that job, then you have to develop a strategy. And it's very important to know what you're doing before he or she reacts. And I think letting your emotions out in the bathroom is fantastic. I thank God for bathrooms that we can go there and cry or whatever we want to do. You know, I think it's a really good thing.
Scream on the wall, right.
Yeah, that's important. Or call a friend, whatever you have to do. However, with the boss, you need to have a strategy. You need to be clear, non-reactive, and not give it any juice so that he doesn't come back at you again, because mm-hmm. they react to juice. If you react to them and you're a victim, then bullies go after victims.
It's a fire. It's like you're feeding the fire. I remember when I was 17 years old, I got a job. I was working in Wall Street, one of my first jobs, and I had somebody who talked down to me so badly, and he was a boss, so I went in the bathroom, and I took toilet paper, and I made balls. I made them wet. And I took him and I threw him with all my might against the door. And it just, that splat, the sound sounded so good. And I wound up for my second one, and when I threw it, he walked in and hit him right in the face.
Ah.
I lost my job on the spot. It was a good solution.
Yeah. No, but with emotional freedom, you need to do the Zen dance around them. You need to learn how to be more empowered than they are. When you're not reacting, if you have a bully boss saying, this, you know, should have sent me flowers, you go, yeah, you know, I know, you know. But don't react. Don't get into it. So they're not getting that energy feedback from you, and it makes them less likely to come back at you. But it requires being very centered and not taking it personally. Hmm. You know, I believe that even if something is meant personally, you don't take it personally. You know, and you have to realize part of emotional freedom is realizing people's suffering. And the reason they act that way isn't because they're happy people, it's because they have wounds. And you know if they're treating you that way, what they're doing in their own head to themselves.
Good point.
Yeah.
Armand, I think you invented primal therapy with that, with those the toilet paper.
The toilet paper was the first one, right?
But also, I like your example of your Italian family, and what it reminds me of, in some settings, and maybe it's a cultural thing, that emotions are very important, and they may have different meanings in that setting, that they may not be threatening, they may not be explosive, and in some settings, people kind of accept emotions, and they feel that they don't really have to always respond to them. They don't have to take them that seriously, so that it's not always a crisis.
Right, exactly. Exactly. Well, if it's, you know, if it's accepted and done in good humor, it's one thing. But if it's done with passive-aggressive digs and it makes people and children feel horrible about themselves and they don't know why, that's not creating freedom. So you have to really look at each example about the happy family who's flinging all of these, you know, emotions back and forth. I believe in the energy of emotions. But what I'm talking about in the book is transforming them, negative ones, because the negative ones build up in your system and they create toxicity in your body and they create physical illness and they create all kinds of depression and anxiety as opposed to being free. You have free space inside of you, but these things build up in you. And part of emotional freedom is clearing it, not by repressing it and not by being saccharine, but saying, I feel angry. This person makes me feel 2 inches tall when they talk to me, and it reminds me of when I was a child and my mother used to talk to me, and I feel like killing them. All right, that's the basic dynamic. And you say, no, you know, all right, I need to heal that, but I need to come from a different, more empowered place by being aware that that's the dynamic, working with it so that every time your buttons get pushed, you're not so reactive. And the thing is with emotional vampires is that they can press your buttons and they could go after you. But if you don't have that reactivity in you, if that's not a really vulnerable point in you and you just think, okay, whatever, they're pressing my button and you don't go for it, then you own that moment.
You know, but how do you decide where that divide is, where that line is between emotions being negative and positive? Because it seems to me that emotions are a double-edged sword, that there's a positive side to emotions. They get us going. They bring us, they help us swing into action. Sometimes they bring us closer to people. They give us a powerful feeling of me, you know, that I'm here, that I'm present. And then there's the negative side of that, too, where people will go on the attack, where it serves me to aggrandize myself, gives me a sense of power, and as you've pointed out in your book with many examples, it can destroy relationships. So, but how do you identify where that line is?
Well, in the book, I talk about the aspects of good stress versus bad stress. Good stress can be, you know, the low to moderate amount of worry that gets you going to take a test or achieve something or get a project ready. But stress can turn against you when you start having physical symptoms, when you start having moods that work against you that decrease your functionality. And so you just have to ask that. You have to ask yourself, what's working for me and what isn't? But usually the low-level kinds of worry and stress can kick you into action. However, there are other means of kicking you into action that are more motivating. Tuning into your intuition and listening to that inner voice inside and waiting for the goosebumps to move you, I would say go with that rather than stress. I think being motivated by stress is a very low level of motivation. It works, you know, sometimes, but I'd rather be motivated by something else than by those goosebumps inside that tell me, yes, this is right and I'm going for it.
Well, you know, also when we talk about emotions, we're also talking about the physiology behind it, that that all these hormones are pouring into our bodies. And often when you're agitated by that flow of hormones, you're not in the best position to make sound, rational kinds of decisions.
So how do you, that's
exactly
a good point. How do you distinguish, Judith, you know, when you're just out of your mind? You know what I mean?
You can feel it.
Well, you can feel. The other day I was watching somebody on steroids who had taken steroids for some skin condition, and she had the skin condition. Suddenly she was outraged at her daughter, right? And she didn't have any idea it was the steroids. The outrage felt real.
Right.
So how do you know when you're in, or is it always that there's something else working on you? You know, maybe the devil makes you do it all the time, whether it be steroids or something else. Maybe there's just some influence that's coming inside that's making people deal in this dysfunctional, aggressive, non-productive and unpretty way.
It's part of themselves. I mean, you could blame it to the outside world forever.
You think it's all our buried stuff?
It's our dark side. It's our lower selves. Yes, we can react in the same way that humanity has been doing it the whole time, but why? It's not working.
When you say lower self, do you think it's it's kind of the inherited self and not necessarily a pathological self, but more of a primitive self that's responding?
Yes, more of the primitive, low-consciousness self that just reacts like the tiger in the jungle as if we were back 50,000 years ago.
So jealousy, for example.
Exactly.
That's a good example. Give me, how do you perceive jealousy now as opposed to jealousy as a primitive, orangutan?
Well, I have a chapter in the book in transforming jealousy and envy, and that's something I've worked with a lot. Not so much jealousy, but envy. I've worked with quite a bit because it really imprisoned me, and I've made quite a bit of progress. But in terms of primordial man, jealousy was about mate guarding, where you'd be jealous of someone else if they wanted to steal your mate, and it challenged all your reproductive capacities, and it was a very primal urge. Now, jealousy is a fear that something's going to be taken away from you, and it could be your job, it could be your wife, it could be your self-esteem, whatever it is. But the antidote to jealousy and envy is true self-esteem.
Judith, there's something, I love talking to you, you know? I love being here with
you.
But every now and then, you give me a glimmer into a spot. And I saw that one on envy just now. Envy was a killer, right? Envy really could just occupy your brain completely.
It can.
Different than jealousy, isn't it? What's the difference?
Well, envy is wanting something that somebody else has, and jealousy is being afraid that something will be taken away from you.
Okay, so envy from your spot. You're a romantic, aren't you? Yes, you are a romantic.
That's true.
That's right. You're a romantic. Envy from your spot is to see and say, they have and I don't have.
That's right. You compare yourself with somebody else, as opposed to with emotional freedom, that comparing, there is a commandment in the book, thou shalt not compare. It's totally irrelevant. What this person's doing over there, what they get or don't get, is irrelevant to your own personal growth, because I truly believe we're given what we need. Whatever it is, we're given what we need, and it's up to us to either work with it or go unconscious with it. But I want to work with it so I can free myself from envy.
How did you free yourself personally from envy? How did you do it? What did you say to yourself? Did you say, Judith, stop it? Or did you say, Judith?
No, that won't work.
Judith, take out a contract on that person. Or did you say, Judith, write enough books so you could have enough money and buy everything?
Well, no. First of all, I realized that envy was a wound in myself, and it had nothing to do with anybody else. It first means taking responsibility for where your vulnerable points are and where you feel insecure and where I had self-doubts. And you know, when I'm envious of somebody, I pray for their success, and I wish them the best of happiness, even if I don't feel it 100%. Because I want to turn that energy around.
That's what you do now.
No, that's what I did when I began to transform.
Right, envy. That's what I mean, to transform. Before you transformed it, when you saw it, you just, what, hated them?
Oh, I felt diminished. I felt small
you
around
hated
other
yourself.
People.
Hated
yeah, I felt
yourself.
I felt I wasn't up to par. I was fit. You know, I was faced with self-doubt. When you feel envy, and I really explored this in my body, because in the book I talk about the energy of emotions. It's like this acid, stinging, horrible, hot feeling in the body when you feel like you're comparing yourself, and they have something you don't have it, and you feel little, and oh, how horrible that is. And I didn't want to feel that way, but I wanted to know what envy was, so I stayed aware of it in my body. I watched it, and I used the techniques that I write about and work with personally to free myself. I don't want to feel it. I want to be able to be happy for other people. I don't want to be one of those people who feels better when someone else fails.
So envy is a form of self-hatred.
Self-doubt, just lack of self-esteem. And self-esteem comes from the power of loving. You know, I see that the real source of self-esteem is about how much love you can create and give, and that is something you can truly feel good about. And it comes from your career, it comes from your relationship and everything, but apart from outside sources, it comes from your capacity to love, and I feel that that's the essence of emotional freedom, is valuing that. I don't think we value that enough in our society, in the world, to feel good about who we are because of our capacity to love, and know the strength that comes from love. And not being cynical and not shutting down, and the strength that comes from self-compassion when we have envy and jealousy, to have mercy on ourselves and work with it gently to transform it into self-esteem, that's part of growth, and that's part of our work here as human beings and humanity, is to work with these personal forces. And then imagine if we had less of them in ourselves and more positive energies, that why would we want to have war in the world?
But Judith, you're an introspective,
right,
centered, romantic person who looks at herself that way. People who are different types can't possibly handle this. I mean, it's not one formula.
I have more faith in people than you do.
No, I have faith in people, but I think it's not as simple as one formula.
You know, Judith,
Judith, I was reading your book, and in there you talk about four emotional types.
That's what I guess I'm relating
to,
yes.
Mm-hmm. The intellect, the empath, the rock, and the gusher. Now, I can definitely identify with the empathic person, because I remember as I was younger, I used to say, wow, I have such a great life if I didn't have all these feelings. And I remember saying that over and over again. Now, when I'm listening to you talk, I'm just wondering, the other side of that for me was, am I going to be a robot? Am I going to have no feelings at all? Mm-hmm. What do you have to say about that?
Balance. Not either or. I too am an emotional empath. That's one of the types I talk about in the book. And an empath is somebody who's very sensitive and intuitive and open, but sometimes feels like a wire without insulation. And we could become emotional sponges, where I know if I don't take care of myself, I could take on somebody else's depression or somebody else's anger, and I start feeling badly in my body, or I start getting anxious or depressed and don't know why, as I sponge it up because I'm so sensitive. But the answer isn't, as my mother used to tell me, to get a thicker skin. That's not the answer. Mm-hmm. We don't want to get a thicker skin. We want to become more sensitive. But
in a way, isn't that a thicker skin?
No.
If the thicker skin is diffuse, so that you don't block the energy, you know what I mean? If the thicker skin is just that it's more airy, you know, if it's more like the ocean, if it's more like the thickness is the bigness of you, not the hard skin that's going to oppose.
As long as
what
it's
we don't
transparent.
Want to do, that's right, as long as it could go through you.
Yeah.
Because it's the most vulnerable you that's probably the safest.
You want to be vulnerable but strong. And that's
absolutely
what I teach in the book, is to be vulnerable and strong and learn techniques to ground and center yourself, so no matter what you face, you're like that sturdy tree in the windstorm where your roots are planted.
Could you describe those other three emotional types? Or the four emotional types, go through those?
Yeah. The other types are, one is the intellectual. And this is somebody who prefers being in the head. They feel most comfortable with the realm of the mind and analysis, and they have very good linear minds. But they're very reluctant to come in their bodies and feel what's going on in their bodies, or even trust intuition, or even believe in spirituality, that there's a higher power, because it, quote, can't be proven, as they don't go sink deep enough into themselves to feel the reality or to feel the essence of that. And so the plus side is that they're really smart and analytical, and where they need to balance themselves is to be more aware of sensuality and the body, and, you know, just to breathe in the air and look at the sunshine, or get involved with, you know, making love and be aware of the body as you're doing it. So that's a way to balance the intellectual. I'm not presenting each emotional type as better or worse than another. I'm just presenting the various types so you can balance them and take the best parts from each.
That's all very fascinating. I think there's another issue here, though, and that is, do we play our game plan or somebody else's game plan? My game plan or your game plan? And here I'm thinking of a New Yorker cartoon where a man is talking on the phone, and he says, I have a half hour to get sucked into your drama. And, you know, and isn't that what the emotional vampire is all about?
Yeah,
Somebody trying to suck us into their drama.
Yes, exactly. And emotional freedom is saying no to that.
Well, how do you identify? Let's talk about emotional vampires. You know, it's such a thing. Emotional vampires, just anybody who comes along who says, I have an emotional need to be engaged and have you engaged in my negativity now. And they come after you and they say, please get involved.
Oh, and they want to press your buttons. For instance, I have a whole chapter in the book on emotional vampires, but one of them is the narcissist. And the narcissist, like the narcissistic personality, it's all about them. It's me, 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 me. And they can be charming and intelligent and seduce you and reel you in, and you think they're the best thing in the world, until you want them to start understanding your feelings, or you don't go along with their game plan about how reality is made. And then they become cold, withholding, and they lack empathy and the capacity for unconditional love. And so never fall in love with a narcissist if you can help it. And certainly in psychotherapy, even if a narcissist wants to change, it takes forever.
But how do you never fall in love with a narcissist? How could you never fall in love with a narcissist?
Oh, by walking the other direction.
Because you mean if somebody comes along who looks like he's a bipolar 2 manic kind of narcissistic, attractive, beautiful person, you just want to walk in the other direction?
in terms of falling in love, yes, because you're asking for trouble and years of trying to win somebody's love who can't give you the empathy and understanding you deserve.
So we're better off finding somebody who feels terribly, terribly bad about themselves and is depressed.
This is balance, balance, balance. No, not that either. You're going to want to find somebody who has some awareness of themselves so they could work with themselves.
You know what the difference here is? The reason that you fall for the narcissist is because you are depressed. When you are depressed, you're looking. It's never not a rule of don't fall in love with a narcissist. Don't fall in love when you're depressed. Because when you're depressed, you're going to be looking for something to pick up your energy. And that narcissist usually offers you some kind of artificial energy that's going to jolt you and say, oh, come on out of that chasm and, you know, we could join me for a while. It's like the cup of coffee you talk about in the kitchen. You know what I mean? It's there. So it's really not, don't fall in love with them. But when you're in that place of depression, don't be looking for love to pull you out. I think might be, what do you think? I mean, do you think that's...
Yes, in part, but I don't think you have to be depressed to fall in love with a narcissist. You can just be madly in love and blind and just see the best person, the best part of somebody, and then it takes, you know, a long time for their dark side to come out, and you realize that they lack empathy, and this is such a crippling of the heart. I think this is one of the worst emotional vampires because they don't understand your feelings. They cannot get it. They cannot resonate with it.
But it's not their dark side coming out. Their dark side was always there. It's your need for them changes. Your light side starts coming out. After a while, you're in a relationship with somebody, and you no longer want to just suck wind to get any kind of favors, you know what I mean? After a while, you say to yourself, wait a minute, this is no good for me anymore. I don't want
Hopefully.
This. And that's the way, yes, and that's when you change it. But it isn't that they've changed, because they've just stayed the way they are.
Yes, but your awareness has changed.
That's right.
And that's what I'm suggesting is that we, when we talk about these emotional vampires to go through, I have a quiz. Are you involved with a narcissist? Here are these qualities. Here is
what
to look for.
Go ahead, shoot for them. How many are they?
Well, you know, is somebody totally self-absorbed?
Is that person self-absorbed?
Yes. Do they always talk about themselves and they don't leave room for you in the conversation? Do you find that when you express your needs that they're not there for you? Or they can't understand where you're coming from? Or if you don't go along with how they view the world, they withhold their energy and become cold and punishing? And do you find you're always trying to win their love? And the only way to win their love is to do what they approve of? You know, these are all signs that you are involved with a narcissist, and it's your choice. You know, you can continue that. But I've worked with patients who have been involved with narcissists in marriages 10, 20, 30 years. It's taken to get out of those marriages because they're so hooked in.
But I could use those same criteria for you. Are you a dependent personality disorder?
Well, that's a good point, because
you know
dependent
I mean?
Personality disorders often get involved with narcissists.
Right. So really,
Absolutely.
If I'm using the diagnostic tool, I'll use the same questionnaire to identify me, because here's where I'm coming from. I mean, yes, you are certainly right about identifying it, and there are many types of emotional vampires, which
right.
is new stuff that you've come up with, but you know we're going to hold that till we get back from our break. This is Armand DeMille. I am with the very exciting crew here of Judith Orloff, Claudia Fox, and Dr. Bernard Starr, and we are talking about emotional freedom, dealing with negativity in life, dealing with it in a way that is productive for you so that you don't just keep repeating the patterns over and over again and swimming in the gunk. We just don't have any room left for more gunk. You know, the world is kind of showing us. It's saying, you know, okay, people, here's the quicksand. Here's the quicksand. Now learn how to swim. So this is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind. We're going to take a very short break. When we come back, a little music, and then more from our fabulous guests.
Don't tell me to stop. Tell the rain not to drop. Tell me everything I'm not. Don't tell me to stop.
Hi, this is Liz Wright. You're listening to WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.
Hello, WBAI listeners and supporters. Tune in Tuesday, March 10th from 9 to 11 p.m. for the first report of 2009 from the WBAI Local Station Board. This month, you'll be introduced to the LSB officers and PNB directors. They'll talk about their responsibilities, recent developments throughout the network, and ask for your ideas on how to build a stronger WBAI. So mark that date on your calendar, Tuesday, March 10th, 9 to 11 p.m., for the first report of 2009 from the WBAI Local Station Board, only on WBAI in New York, 99.5 on your FM dial.
Here we go, 3, 2.
Schubert, Piano Trio in E flat major, opus 100, the second movement, from Barry Lyndon. Chose that because of a special association to it, but also for the part of it that cries out to our heart, you know? I mean, underneath all of this discussion that we're having about emotional freedom and how to live, we're really talking about how to be, and how to be in a way that's more beautiful in life. And we've had such a world of people who are desperately searching and grabbing at each other and trying so hard to make life work. So Judith Orloff sits by the ocean, and she contemplates and says, how do I improve myself? How do I liberate myself from the negativity of life? And Bernard Starr and Claudia Fox, they kind of study themselves. We look at ourselves to see where can we change our part of it. Because like I said, you grow up in the family I grew up in. Rage was how we made the soup. You know what I mean? I mean, if you're going to have, we're going to make the sauce, okay, throw in some rage. How about a little guilt? How about a little, you know, it was all, and this is not just to make fun of my family, but it was there all the time, and it was part of the energy. It's what we expected life to be. I went to school as a kid where everybody punished you. They'd punish you for everything you did. You get beaten or hit or slapped for anything that you did. If you got your schoolwork wrong, you got punished. They got put in closets. We expected that's the way life is. People grow up nowadays, and people in today's world think that life is like this. It's about being devious, hiding, about not being yourself, about not being connected. It's about defending yourself. So someone like my three guests come along, and they say, no. Let's up the ante a little. Let's make it a little better. Judith Orloff is with me. And Judith, this has been your life work, huh?
Well, you know, it took me 4 years to write Emotional Freedom. And as you said, I was by the ocean quite a bit, you know, with the writing and, you know, quite a quiet life. To contemplate and to work with these negative emotions in myself and to be able to communicate to my readers how to work with them too. That's very important to me because I see emotional freedom as an inner peace movement. And when we could find a semblance of inner peace, which is so important to have that on a daily basis, at least some, that can resonate out to the world with more of an outer peace movement because we can resonate that and we can be the change that we so desperately want to create. But we have to start with our own hearts. And most people walk around in our society without a sense of peace. It's such a sense of struggle and suffering all the time. That's not what I want for myself. I mean, that's why I wrote Emotional Freedom, and that's why I work with the principles myself in my own life, as well as teach them to my patients and workshop participants.
Well, in order for you to find the emotional freedom, though, and the emotional peace that you're talking about, you say you really need to set up boundaries.
Yes.
You cannot do it. You as an empath.
Right.
See, I don't find the boundaries as necessary for me because stuff doesn't get through to me the way that it does to you.
No, you have a different constitution
right. Than
I do. But, you know, as we both share, we're very sensitive and open. And, you know, I feel everything. I feel the ripples of what goes on in the world. And so I've had to learn how to set clear limits and boundaries. And some of the techniques that I suggest for empaths in the book is to really have your alone time, have that carved out for yourself. It's very important that you're not inundated with the world or inundated with people, that you need to have your own space. That's the hallmark of an empath, is they go home alone to replenish themselves. They don't get replenished by people necessarily. They go home alone, and they love to take their own car places so that they can get out quickly, you know, whereas somebody else, you know, might love a social evening of 5 to 6 hours, of, you know, but empaths don't typically like that. And so empaths are also very sensitive to smells, excessive talking, and sound. I could go into an elevator and smell somebody's perfume, and I feel like I'm being nuked, you know, and another person will say, oh, isn't that a beautiful smell? You see?
Yeah, I find that as an empath, I am very sensitive to those things.
Yeah.
And I do meditate twice a day.
Good.
Which is a tremendous, tremendous help for me.
Me too. That's my primary practice is meditation. And it's by closing your eyes and going inside of yourself to center yourself. A 3-minute meditation that I talk about in the book, I practice all day long, you know, to center myself, and especially on book tour because I get so thrown off by airports and all the people and the, you know, and all the energy in that place. I go into the bathroom and I breathe and I center myself and I do the 3-minute meditation so then I can go back out stronger.
Can you show us the 3-minute meditation? Do it now.
Yes. Well, the 3-minute meditation is finding a comfortable place to sit. And, you know, it could be anywhere, but just finding some semblance of privacy if you can. Close the door of your office or, you know, go into the bathroom or just sit wherever you're sitting and close your eyes and just begin to focus on the breath, the sacred prana, something that we Westerners don't appreciate so much, is the power of the breath, and focus on the sensuality of the breath. And as the thoughts come, let them go by like clouds in the sky, the fears and the laundry list of things to do and worries. Just practice letting them float by and refocusing on the breath like a hypnotic incantation, coming back to the breath over and over and over again, just sitting very quietly. And then hold an image in your mind, a very positive, beautiful image. I have my image that I use is a flowing river with the reflection of the stars in it, the night sky. This is a very beautiful grounding image to me. And so I sit, and you focus on whatever image that you feel is powerful. It could be a forest, a sunset, a piece of earth, whatever it is for you. And hold that in your vision for 3 minutes as you're breathing, to keep breathing. And then say thank you for that and keep on moving. Go back out to the airport. Go back out to your wife or your children, whatever you need to do. But you do it from that centered place.
Because when you do it from that centered place and when you find that spot inside you, if you take that little break, you reconnect.
You reconnect with yourself and you're free.
Yeah. Because otherwise you're just one of the slaves.
That's right. Exactly.
You're on automatic.
On automatic and you're not feeling any peace.
So let's try it one more time with our audience, if you don't mind, Judith, okay? Since they've heard the words, let's go there again.
All right, everyone, wherever you are, and this is a technique in emotional freedom, this will give you immediate results. Just sit down, close your eyes, wherever you are.
Take your time.
Take a few deep, slow breaths. Just begin to feel the inhalation, the exhalation, the chest moving upward and downward. And just begin to feel the sensuality and the freedom of the breath. Just settling into your body. And if the cloud and if the negative thoughts come, picture them as clouds drifting slowly in the sky, bringing yourself back to the breath, feeling comfort in that. And then focus on an image, anything that you consider beautiful, soothing, positive, illuminating, luminous. And just allow your attention to drift and focus on that image, gently, no pressure, letting it ground and center you and enjoying it. Just breathing in the beauty and the positivity of that image. Feeling more relaxed and peaceful and freer, more space within, more centered. Just give yourself the time to come back to your center using this technique. Enjoying it. It's pleasurable. It makes you strong. It makes you positive. And it allows you to come from that place no matter what you're dealing with.
Nice work, Judith. Nice work bringing us all four with you, with you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Nice to go there with us, isn't it? It's surprising that you could step into a studio, right?
Yes.
And say, ooh, look, here in a little gem of New York. Right? You find what you need.
Yes, you do.
Dr. Starr.
It's amazing to do meditation on the radio. Very, very unique. And, of course, that meditative state, as we all just experienced, is a very peaceful state. And that peacefulness, though, is beyond thought and it's beyond emotion. I mean, that's where the peacefulness resides. So it brings up the question, is that the way to achieve peacefulness, to get beyond thought, beyond emotion? Or is it possible to be peaceful within an emotional context, you know, in the eye of the storm?
That's exactly the point of emotional freedom, is you practice it in the quiet moments so you could find it in the eye of the storm. You don't start in the eye of the storm. You start in these supportive environments where you can find that peace and find what the center feels like and practice so that when your mother is screaming at you or blaming you, that you can go back to that place in that moment, or your boss is being a bully or a narcissist or hurting your feelings, you could come back to that place and do the 3-minute meditation. That's where you put it into action, you see. But you've got to practice in non-stressful moments, not only because it's enjoyable and wonderfully connecting, but it develops your muscles so that you're ready when the time comes, so you're not reactive and you know how to get back to that freeing place again.
You have to have a you with you that you can bring with you. If you don't have that you, you know, I like the image, and I think I shared this image with you the last time you were here, of it being like a cyclone. And there's an emotional cyclone that's going on. And here you are, and the cyclone's coming at you, and you know if this emotional cyclone grabs you, it's going to toss you up in the sky and rip you apart. So you have a choice. You can try to bury your head under the ground, but most cyclones will just stay right on top of you and suck you out of the ground anyway and pull you up, or you'll bury yourself so far down that you'll be dead. Right? See, that's not a very successful way. A lot of other people try to jump out of the cyclone by going through the edges of it, the wall of it. And by going through it, that means you have to get in it. You get in the argument. You get in the fight. And you hope you're going to break through to the other side. That's why people, when they're having arguments with their husbands or wives, hoping there's going to be a resolution. Any minute now, it's going to get better. And then you notice 20 minutes later, it's just gotten worse. Right. So that doesn't work. So the solution seems to be to step in the eye of the storm and to move with it, that as it moves, you move too, but you don't give in. You're not a part of it. You don't give into it. That you could actually, as it moves, you move with it, and in that way, it dissipates. It loses its power. It burns itself out.
Yes, and part of emotional freedom is not fighting and not going into that tit-for-tat mentality. It's about having a bit of a witness state and going, all right, this is an uncomfortable situation. My spouse is yelling at me and being unreasonable. How can I handle it? So all of this inner dialogue is going on instead of you lashing back. It's just too easy to lash back, and it doesn't get anywhere.
Sometimes, though, Judith, you know, let's say you have a 5-year-old kid who's yelling at you, and he's, I hate you, I hate you, I hate you, and I'm not going to do it, and I'm not going to do my homework, and I'm not going upstairs, and I'm not going to do it, and starts hitting you, right? Now, at some point, you may say to yourself, Om Renge Kyo, you know, you could go there, or you could say to the child, you know, no, and you yell at the kid because the shock of yelling stops him in his tracks, and it's exactly what he was waiting for.
Right, but you don't do it from an angry place. You just do it in terms of volume.
So that's you're saying different. At times you can have arguments with people.
It's not an argument. It's setting a boundary and limit with a firm and loud tone for a child. You need to set those limits. That's kindness. But what I'm not suggesting is getting into tit-for-tat, blaming arguments, screaming arguments, and then having the relief of that, and then making love and getting into a passionate kind of connection, and then the next day you have another argument. There's no resolution.
So the answer is not that you limit the emotions to a point where there is no manifestation of the passions.
Oh, no.
No,
good
no.
point. No, no, no. You still have your passion. You're not bland or detached.
Yeah, that's what I'm hearing you say.
No, no. Oh, no. This is the most passionate. You know, because you're saying, you know, I'm not getting involved with this. I think it's really you're misconstruing passion with getting into fights. People confuse that a lot. If I get into a fight with somebody, I'm passionate. And I don't agree with that at all. I don't think that's passion. Passion is something else. You know, passion comes from, you know, a deeper place, not fighting. I think that's the old values. If I fight with someone, I really love them, and so I have all this passion. I don't think that's passion. I think that's negative energy. And it's like a searching, it's clamoring for passion, but it's not the real thing.
Let me ask you, Claudia, while I've got you here. So often you guide people and you help people to try to find their central place, their passions, and you're looking for them to find their that's what you teach. It's your goal, right? Along the way, when you see them bent emotionally, Do you at all try to center them? Do you all try to bring them? What do you do?
Absolutely. Well, I have a lot of practice in dialoguing, and I think it's very similar to what Judith is talking about. And when the negative voices come up and those feelings come up, it's really a matter of one voice in my head talking to the other, and I do impart that with the people that I'm working with. Passion for life and for an interest is looking for something that you find joy in. And I do agree with Judith that the fighting is not the passion. So I bring them back to a center of calm, often using meditation. I do role play, and I will have a group of people and see that the one person is in the middle and everyone plays their voices. And it's just incredible what they begin to see about themselves. So I do think you have to come to a place of centeredness in order to then go out and do anything.
What I'm hearing here are a lot of examples of sticking to your game plan rather than getting sucked into somebody else's game plan. I have a great example of that. I once had a student, a guy, when I was teaching at Brooklyn College, and he almost never spoke in class, except when he did. When he raised his hand, you knew he was going for your jugular vein, that he caught you in some contradiction or something that you said that was wrong. And he was usually right. Okay, and I liked having him there because it added a lot of juice to the course. Not many other people spoke. It was kind of deadly, and he added life to it. I ran into him once in the cafeteria, and I said, you know, I like having you in the class. I said, but I have a feeling that you only speak when you go on the attack. And that's fine because I find it very engaging. But I'll bet you're having a lot of problems in other classes. And boy, the floodgates opened at that point. Because I knew my colleagues, they wouldn't appreciate that kind of attack. And he was having big time trouble. He was failing almost everything. But the consequence of that, and it was not intentional on my part, but I learned something from it, he never spoke again in class. He never spoke again because he knew he couldn't get to me. And the vampire will look for another place to suck blood.
That's the essence of emotional freedom that I'm talking about in the book, is when they can't get to you, they lose interest. You see, but if you go for the bait and they know they can get your button and they could press it, then they're coming back over and over again. But if you're not vulnerable to that kind of attack, they go on to the next victim.
You know, it reminds me of the way that you treat people who are stalking you in some way, you know, or people who are doing phone abuse. You hang up the phone.
Right. You don't
get involved.
No.
You don't. But, you know, the people who do get involved, when you suddenly hear them saying to you, you know, and I thought maybe if I talked to him, he would stop calling me.
No.
You know, it's you needing that.
Right.
When you're inviting the vampires in, it's because your blood is pouring out of your body.
Oh, absolutely. You don't dialogue with that. And you know, in emotional freedom, I talk about fear, and that the more you focus on fear, the more you feed it. And the less you focus on something and you give it energy, the less it's fed. You want to feed what's positive and beautiful and passionate and sensitive and intuitive. You want to feed that. You want your attention to go there, even in these economic times. You want to balance your concerns with these other things so your attention is redirected toward the positive, and that can build in you. That's the point of emotional freedom, is to consciously build what's positive, the positive mind, this beautiful show that we're on. You know, how to do that? Emotional freedom is all about building the positive mind. And every way we can do that, not by becoming numb or detached or lack of passion, it's by having a choice about how we respond. You know, I don't enjoy fighting. I used to have these horrible knockdown dragouts with my mother for years. You know, we would disagree and I would rebel, and, you know, and so forth. And, it, you know, before her death, we really came to quite a resolution. But I haven't fought with someone for, you know, for such a long time. It doesn't interest me to fight. It doesn't interest me to fight.
Yeah,
it has no appeal to me.
You know, Armand, you brought up children before, and I was just really curious, Judith, do you have any wisdom to impart to parents on maybe one of the most important things that they could do to help their children grow up emotionally free?
Modeling. You be what you want your children to learn. As you can talk about it till the end of the world, and if you're not it, they're not going to do it. So you've got to be it. You've got to be patient. You've got to be able to set boundaries. You have to be able to say no to them. And you have to show them that you are absolutely committed to overcoming the negative in your life, and it's not something you want to feed in yourself or them. And if you can give them that message, you're giving them a great service and also encouraging them to trust their intuition because you trust yours. And you're able to go inside, and you're more than just a disembodied head. You're able to tune into your gut and be in your body too. And when children see that, you know, then that's the way to teach them the principles of emotional freedom, because they see you're living it. And if they see your passion for it, then they'll develop a passion for it. You see, it's like monkey see, monkey do with children and parents. That's the most important thing.
Well, Judith Orloff. Judith, I want to thank you so much for being back with us.
You're very welcome.
It's a really beautiful thing. We are we're here today. The name of the book is Emotional Freedom. Liberate yourself from negative emotions and transform your life. Let's talk about the website.
My website is drjudithorloff.com. And there's all kinds of information about how to get emotional freedom. Plus, there's a bunch of free gifts you can get with the book, too, now for a special offer. And my book tour schedule is on the website, drjudithorloff.com, as are free articles, videos, and all kinds of free information that you could draw on any time of the day or night to learn about emotional freedom, intuition, relationships, compassion, the unknown, the mystery, psychiatry, the whole thing.
And the ocean. Armand DeMille, Dr. Bernard Starr, Claudia Fox, thanks for being with us. You can get a copy of today's program by going to thepositivemind.com. You could just listen to it, pass it on. My special thanks to all of you and to everybody here who's a part of this Positive Mind radio program, Michael especially. Thank you so much for now. Bye-bye.
Dear listeners, safe on your